What can you say about the North American love story with pickup trucks?
What could I say about that? I could say certainly the pickup truck has taken on a deep symbolic value, I think, for a lot of people who own them. It's not just how they get around. It sort of says something about who they are, their ability to, you know, handle any task that comes at them, you know, go anywhere what they choose, carry a bunch of stuff with them. How, you know, the pickup truck is like how you help the friends that are your really good friends. Oh, can I borrow your truck? We got to take this thing to the dump or whatever. So there really is sort of a kind of love affair surrounding people in their trucks. And guys love to customize them and put, you know, bumper stickers and things like that that identify, you know, this is who I am in my truck. And that it's a real identity thing.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States and now Canada. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Canadian author Chris Turner about his book, The Patch, The People, Pipelines, and Politics of the Oil Sands. This program was made possible with the generous support of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and was recorded at their studio in Calgary, Alberta. Learned a lot of new truck vernacular while reading your book called The Patch. And for our listeners who are unfamiliar, will you just begin by describing The Patch?
Right. So the patch in particular that I'm describing, the patch is one of these sort of industry shorthand terms for a number of different sort of places where there's been a lot of oil and gas development. This is one about the oil sands region of northern Alberta. So basically this very large industrial site in northern Alberta, a good, you know, 4.5 hours northeast of Edmonton, where there is more than 3 million barrels a day of oil produced from bitumen, which is this very heavy, sludgy stuff. It's not your typical crude oil. It basically has to be mined or else liquefied and then pumped to the surface. And was a thing Canadian entrepreneurs and the Canadian government have been playing around with, looking for a way to make profitable for nearly 100 years, when suddenly in the late 90s it became a very profitable business indeed.
And you begin the book with 1,611 ducks.
Yes.
Why start there?
Well, the reason I began with the ducks, I think two reasons. The first is that this was actually how, for a lot of people, this was maybe one of the first things they ever heard about Alberta's oil sands industry. If you weren't, most Canadians had heard of it, but particularly outside of Canada, that basically there had been this incident. These ducks had landed on a tailings pond, which is the waste. It's a very common mining term, but no one had ever seen it in terms of oil production. This basically where all the excess from the mining and processing gets shunted into a pond where the bad stuff settles out and the good stuff gets returned, ideally to the environment. Ducks normally are deterred from landing on these ponds by sound cannons and various other deterrents. They hadn't been put in place. The ducks landed, the sort of waste bitumen in the pond dragged them down and killed them. It was extraordinarily graphic. The images that came out of it reminded people, I'm sure, of Exxon Valdez and other oil spills. And that was really, for the industry, I think the first time it was well aware, I guess, of how much international scrutiny it was now under. So that was the one part of it. And then the second part, I think, is that it really was a turning point for the industry and its place in the Canadian economy, in the global conversation about environmental stewardship and climate change, where, you know, to that point, it had been largely this kind of success story, this sort of technological story of mastery of this incredibly difficult resource, this, you know, job creation engine in Canada's north, a new Klondike, that kind of thing. And although the other conversation had already begun after 2008, the dominant conversation in a lot of circles about the oil sands was about the environmental damage that it was causing.
I want to get to the environmental piece and the climate change element, but first I want you to take us to Fort McMurray.
Right.
Will you do a short little reading?
Sure, here? I can do that. All right. It is a workplace of tradespeople, skilled technicians and engineers, where office spaces are often set in the midst of vast industrial operations, and even the white-collar workers have job titles that speak of intimacy with raw earth, geologists and geophysicists, chemists and reservoir engineers. These are workers who go to site in bright white half-ton pickup trucks caked with boreal dirt. These are parents who drive to school and the grocery store in meticulously maintained 4x4 trucks. GMC Sierras, Chevy Silverados Z71s, Dodge Ram 1500 5.7-liter Hemis, and Ford F-150 FX4s, some of them jacked up high above the slop on oversized tires and elongated shock absorbers and struts via the status symbol of a lift kit. These are families who celebrate weekends and holidays by latching campers and cargo trailers to their lifted pickups and loading them full of ATVs and snowmobiles and dragging the whole motorized circus to campsites down long backwoods roads thick with mud and snow where four-wheel drive is a legitimate necessity. This is a land of trucks built by trucks for trucks to mine more fuel for all those trucks. And there they all are in the Alberta pre-dawn on Highway 63, headed north to the site. At times, the traffic seems composed of almost nothing but those generic white worksite pickups, big F-350s and Ram 2500s with the names of oil companies and oil field service firms stenciled on the door. Suncor and Syncrude and Shell, Aecon and Schlumberger and Halliburton, local welding and electrical and pipe fitting contractors. And then there are the much larger trucks, service trucks and dump trucks, cement mixers and tanker trucks, trucks with built-in elaborate industrial gear for cleaning and fixing oil field equipment, flatbeds topped with huge pipe and massive hunks of fabricated steel, 18-wheelers hauling sea containers or double trailers. There's so much heavy trucking traffic, it can seem as though there must be some kind of major emergency project in need of resupply out there in the woods. Such is the daily traffic flow in the patch.
In chapter two, you introduce a refrain, man develops his world,
right?
Exclamation. I was hoping, number one, that you could say it to me, how you meant it to be read at that right. point tonally.
Yeah.
How would you say it?
I think something like, man develops his world.
Right. Yeah. What's the tonal purpose of this phrase?
So first of all, it's a phrase that comes from the banners that hung over the opening of the first oil sands mine in 1967 at what is now Suncor. At the time was Great Canadian Oil Sands. And I think what it captures, and the reason I picked up on it, is really the spirit of how this thing came to be. We're now in a very different conversation about the oil sands and what it means to the global energy industry, to climate change. But at the time, in the late 60s, this was really the sort of peak of the idea of big machines doing amazing things, that sort of technocratic triumph over nature. And that really, I think, was kind of encapsulated by when they announced, we have finally figured out how to make oil out of this stuff that has vexed us for half a century. We're developing our world. We're making good things out of nothing. We've taken this, this messy thing in the forests of Alberta and turned it into the most valuable commodity on earth. Isn't that just an extraordinary achievement? And the photos are very, in the book I described them, they look like stills from Citizen Kane. It's, these very serious men at these big tables, very pleased with what they've done.
And I notice by page 110, it shifts to italics and lowercase. And it's accompanied by this term, high modernity. And I was wondering if you could just describe the character of high modern.
Right. So the phrase high modern is often used to refer, so modernism generally, obviously, or modernity is the sort of rise of industrial age development. But in particular, the high modern, which is the really big technocratic stuff. So it's sometimes used in conjunction, for example, with communist regimes. So the Soviet Union building huge dams, building massive structures almost for the sake of it, and creating huge industry. But it's also that whole era of industrial development after World War II, where oil becomes the sort of dominant fuel and really large stuff. So the high modern in Canada, for example, is not just the oil sands. There's also, it was an era, the 50s and 60s, of huge dam building and uranium mining. And so basically, kind of gets at that sense that man develops his world kind of sense of, we now are, godlike in our ability to move Earth and change the very nature of the planet to suit our needs.
Speaking of the planet, there's another character that appears throughout, the boreal forest.
Right.
And for those of us, in Montana or in the United States, can you just give us an imagistic impression of what it looks like?
Right. So the boreal forest looks like a lot of different things because it's massive.
Okay.
It's basically a giant, thick stripe of forest from the Pacific coast all the way almost to the Atlantic coast in Canada. It's what's north of where most of the people live. So most of the people in Canada live within 100 kilometers of the U.S. border in a fairly urbanized environment that is very similar to American urban environments.
Right.
But then above that, in most of Canada, is this boreal forest, which is very, very dense mixed forest. It's where a lot of the sort of great sort of wild mammals and bears and deer and huge caribou herds and that sort of thing. So I think when people sort of think of Canada as this sort of vast wilderness and you think of, you know, images of First Nations hunters and trappers and the first French Canadian voyageurs who came and trapped fur, that sort of thing, moving through these, you know, extraordinary wildernesses, that a lot of that is the boreal forest.
You straddle a line in this book, not being overtly on one side or the other, mm-hmm. and yet there is this tone that comes across. And your voice comes through in sentences like these, so I'm going to read this to you and ask you a question.
Sure.
This was a new consumer age of plastic, fantastic engineering, and abundant technological gadgetry, a time of expansive growth, bigger houses on broader lawns, braggadocious fins on ever larger cars. How did you keep the reins on and not spin out in either direction, Chris?
Well, I think it was very willfully. I felt like this was a topic that had more than enough opinion thrust upon it. There was already plenty of very, very strong pro or anti sentiment regarding the oil sands. And so my intention, as much as I could, was not to pick one of those sides so much as to portray the actors in the drama as accurate as I could. So in the case of what you're the sentence you just read, talking about how it was we came to build this, you know, very elaborate, high modern world with the dependence on oil and other fossil fuels that it has, it really was to meet what was considered an ideal at the time, this idea of, you know, that sort of suburban living and going everywhere you want in a car that keeps getting bigger with each new model year and all that sort of stuff. There was a real, you know, a real sort of vision of the good life embedded there. And then similarly, when I get into the criticism of the industry, the opposition to it, the, you know, protest movement that has come to mount against it, I try as accurately as possible to describe the feelings, the thoughts, the ideas driving that, rather than to necessarily sympathize with one or the other. And so, yeah, it was very much I decided fairly early on in the research, actually, that I would probably remove myself entirely from the story. I wasn't going to say, here I am meeting people, you know, in Fort McMurray or whatever else. I was just going to kind of, as much as possible, you know, take an overhead view and say, look at them doing what they do.
I can't wait to talk to you about the point of view element. Mm. But before that, I want to ask you, can you describe the differences or similarities between Canadian and American climate change activists?
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of overlap and a lot of interaction actually now. But if you go back, you know, 10 years or so on, I think, for one thing, Canadian climate change activism more or less felt like it had, or at least could potentially have, a sympathetic ear among policymakers. Canada had been, you know, all the way back in the 1980s, had been talking a really good game on climate change, you know, leading international discussions, making grand statements, signing out of the Kyoto Protocol, et cetera, doing a little bit in terms of actual on-the-ground action, but more than anything, at least, you know, accepting the fact that this is a major, you know, major challenge that we need to address and that we need to begin thinking through how we are going to do so and that sort of thing. So I think the Canadian climate change activist community, so insofar as you could generalize, felt like we are capable of getting a hearing at least. And that began to change with Stephen Harper coming in as prime minister and his government, and which coincided with the really peak years of the boom and the patch. But even to that point, you know, you look at one of the groups that I talk about, a very prominent kind of watchdog group here in Alberta, the Pemina Institute, and they very much felt a kind of almost collegial relationship that they had with even the bigger oil companies, that they could call them up and ask for a meeting and say, look, this is, you know, this is the stuff that we are going to be telling our membership and telling, you know, policymakers that we think is a problem with your industry, and mm-hmm. so be aware that, you know, this is where the criticism is coming from. So there was that kind of relationship, whereas I get the sense anyway that for American climate change activists, it had just been sort of one frustration after another. There was really a sense that, you know, maybe there might be things happening at the local or state level, but one federal government after another was not that interested in doing all that much, particularly, obviously, you know, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were not sympathetic to the cause in any significant way. So I think there was a more combative, adversarial kind of approach to the whole thing built right into the movement in the U.S. And, I mean, I think for good reasons. I mean, Canada historically has kind of been a, you know, environmental stewardship leader in a lot of ways, and felt like it had a sort of duty to not just our country but the world to try and address these big issues, things like, you know, the CFCs and the ozone layer, acid rain, these sorts of things. Canada had taken a lead internationally, whereas the U.S., I think, had more of a, you know, kind of strategic idea around these things at a government level.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Chris Turner, the Canadian author of The Patch, The People, Pipelines, and Politics of the Oil Sands. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What do you think most Americans don't comprehend about the Alberta oil sands?
Well, I think to begin with, most Americans, if they've heard of them, think that they are something that rose out of sort of virgin soil in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Whereas this is something that, you know, successive Canadian governments, Canadian companies, and, you know, a mix of the two, had been trying to turn into a viable resource for a century. And it was very much a government-led, government-funded to some degree project. This was not, you know, a handful of big oil companies coming up with some crazy scheme and going and drilling holes in the earth, as you see with, for example, like the wave of fracking and that sort of thing. The oil sands was already a really large industrial project by the late 70s. Mm-hmm. It was a failing industrial project at the time. It was not making money, but it was already, by that point, you already had significant public investment, a lot of momentum, you know, at the provincial level of government here in Alberta, and then nationally to make it work, that, you know, we'd put this much time and effort into it. It's oil. It's, you know, if you have it, you use it, you know, remains to some degree the attitude. So once it came onto the radar of, you know, American climate change activists, the American government talking about pipelines, that sort of thing, it was already a really large and growing industrial force.
In the book, you say before you went to go visit, you tried to inoculate yourself by going to other large industrial sites like the Grand Coulee Dam.
Right.
What was your reaction both to those sites and then when you finally saw the oil sands yourself?
Well, I think, you know, the Grand Coulee Dam is a good example. It has a visitor center and laser light projections as a show and the rest of it, because those things are kind of awe-inspiring. I mean, it's hard, yeah. You know, it's like looking at a 100-story building or any crazy feat of human engineering.
A rocket ship.
You just kind of stand back and go, oh my God, that's, how did they even do that? And then you can, you know, in the case of the Grand Coulee Dam, they take you on a tour and they say, here's how they did that. Build a giant artificial lake in the course of doing it and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, like to some degree, you know, like you look at the landscape around you and you think this has had a significant impact. But really, I think for a lot of people who look at that, certainly for me, it's as much sort of awe at the feats of human engineering as it is shock at how greatly we can alter the environment. And so that was kind of how I felt when I first visited an oil sand site. I mean, everything is very, very large, but so is the landscape itself. And I think that's one of those things you don't quite get when you've only seen, you know, a photo taken from a certain angle, out of context, that sort of thing. Yes, the industrial site itself is quite something to look at. The kind of processing area of it looks like all other oil infrastructure. I'd also been to, you know, oil refineries on the Gulf Coast of Texas, so I knew this is, I mean, that's what they look like. It's these, you know, millions of pipes snaking everywhere and steam and fire shooting out of the tops of these, these stacks and that sort of thing. That's what it looks like. And then in the case of an oil sands site, it's surrounded by this very large open pit mine, which looks like open pit mines do. That's what they look like. But in the case, you know, when you're there, you know, you drive half an hour north of Fort McMurray to get there through Boreal Forest. You can keep driving past the oil sand sites deeper into the Boreal Forest. In the course of the research, I flew over several of the major oil sand sites going back and forth to Fort Chippewa and just on the little commercial airline that does that run. And you get a sense of, one, yes, these are very, very large footprints on the earth, but the scale of the wilderness itself there is extraordinary. And I think at that level, not that necessarily says that this isn't a significant impact, but it's a significant impact in an enormous swath of wilderness.
Landscape, In the acknowledgments, you write about the reticence of the oil execs to talk to you, mm-hmm. as well as other folks. Mm-hmm. How did this roadblock influence your work, and how does it inform the problem?
Well, I think, first of all, to characterize the roadblock, there was no overt pushback.
Yeah.
So the oil companies that I approached and said, one, I'd be interested in talking to folks at your, you know, whether it's senior executives or actually I was more interested in talking to people who drove trucks and worked as engineers on site and that sort of thing. And then I would also love to spend some time, you know, on a site if that's possible. The answers were wound up being uniformly no. Some were more open to the possibility than others, but they all eventually came around to no. The attitude was not, we don't want this book written and we're going to try and stop you or block it. It was, we're not going to openly participate because, you know, really, I think I'm almost like at an internal corporate culture level, this doesn't work out well for us. And we look like we've given someone, you know, handed someone a critique. And so they'd been one after another, the most recent one that someone pointed out to me, one of the media guys who I was talking to said, you know, we had Bill Nye, the science guy's production team come up here and talk our ears off about how they wanted to talk about the engineering involved and some of the stuff that we were doing in terms of mediating some of the environmental impacts. And then when the thing ran, it was another dirty oil attack job. And so we don't feel like we ever get a fair hearing, so we're not going to help you out. But similarly, a number of the very, very prominent vocal critics of the industry never got back to me either. So I think there's and I'm sure all of these are for, you know, reasons of time and scheduling and interest. There's lots of other factors involved. But I think some of it, too, is on both the kind of industry booster side and the critic side, the theater of, you know, open conflict with only two possible ways of looking at the thing serves them. The much more complex nuance of it doesn't so much, because then you get into stuff like, you know, the fact, I mean, which I talk about in the book to some degree, you know, the climate impact of the oil sands has been overstated by its critics repeatedly. And that doesn't mean that the basis of their critique isn't valid. It is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions, but the threatened scale of it is nowhere near what, for example, Bill McKibben and James Hansen have suggested repeatedly.
Right. You write about the lack of nuance in the debate, and there's this line, there is no common ground, and that is how both sides lose. Right. Does that pertain to your choice to write in the point of view of an omniscient third person throughout most of the book?
Yeah, well, I think that comes from the final chapter, which was where I did feel obliged, in part because I, you know, of what I had learned over the course of writing the book, in part because, you know, I've written on a much more personal level about climate change and climate change solutions. And so I felt I should at some point at least acknowledge that I've, you know, I have my own thoughts on this. So that's more where I'm speaking from in my own voice. And I think, you know, we're seeing this, you know, as we speak now, you know, half a year after the book came out, where there is a pitched and growing battle over a pipeline that is, you know, that proposed to run from Edmonton to Vancouver to bring, you know, more bitumen to the Pacific coast for shipping. And I can see why the industry and why, you know, various levels of government want that pipeline built. I can see why activists in the Lower Mainland of BC and First Nations along the route don't want it built. The intensity and growing viciousness of the debate, though, I don't think leads to a particularly good result for anyone. I think it entrenches this very deep opposition. I think it is wind in the sails of reactionary conservative forces in Canadian politics that will make a lot out of these crazy environmentalists who are against your jobs and against your livelihood. I think it further stagnates the debate around what we're going to do about climate change rather than beginning to solve it. Mm-hmm. So.
It's interesting because I'm looking at the cover of your book. It's quite ominous. It's black and sort of oily. And the title is white. And I'm sitting here with you and you're wearing all gray. even your jacket's gray. Okay. Do you think that's your strength as a writer, is being able to find the gray?
I hope that maybe my strength as a writer is at the very least being willing to question the simpler explanations for things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have written a couple of books on the solutions to climate change, and that came from, I think, a time this, you know, the first of those books I began researching around like 2004, 2005, when there was a lot of despair in climate science circles. You know, the scientists and the people who pay close attention to scientists were beginning to awaken to the scale of the problem and how quickly it was probably going to unfold. And at the time, extraordinarily little was being done on the ground to do anything about it. And so rather than sort of take that as where we stood, and dig in on the gloom of it, mm-hmm. which is what a lot of the writing about climate change at the time and since has done. I thought, well, there's someone somewhere must be doing something that will help at one point, at some point or another. And so really chasing solutions. So maybe, I don't know, but if that's looking for gray so much as, you know, trying to peek around the obvious answer and see is there more going on there than people are willing to allow is happening. And certainly with this book, The Patch, the intention was, you know, here is this piece of the global energy industry, this major piece of Canada's economy that is talked about constantly. And yet, you know, the vast majority of people who talk about it have no real sense of what they're even describing. So it felt like a thing that needed a lot more nuance brought to the discussion.
I think the book is quite successful at that. And I was carried along with you and with the voice. And then at the end, when the narrator comes in, when you come in, I was heartbroken when I read this sentence. I am dug in is what I mean. Why do you think you had to write about your own complicity?
Because I think it's really unhelpful to pretend that the scale and scope and power of the oil industry is something that exists outside of all of our daily lives and daily choices. I'm not a big fan of the what's sometimes been called hair shirt environmentalism, where you personally go without in order to make a show of your sacrifice. But I do think we need to recognize there's only so much you can do on the supply side of the fossil fuel equation until there are really serious things done about the demand. I mean, as long as demand continues to grow, and it is, in the course of my writing the book and the extraordinarily pitched debate over what was to happen with the Keystone XL pipeline, the United States added, 4 million barrels of oil per day to its production? So we're not winning the war at this point on the demand side. There's still extraordinary demand for the commodity itself. And so I think that's what I wanted to make explicit there. And also because I think particularly in the case of the oil sands, there had been a tendency, even among Canadians quite proximate to it, to act like it was this otherworldly thing, this aberration that had occurred as opposed to an extension of the backbone of our economy. And so we do have to, I think, take a certain amount of responsibility. And this is something, you know, I don't like to go too far into the, you know, how did you get to the protest? Oh, you didn't
right.
You know.
You didn't ride your bicycle.
No, yeah. Even if you did, you know, what's the bicycle made of? But I don't like that particular part of the debate. But I do think you see, I mean, here in Canada, for example, regions being pitted against each other as if we aren't all, you know, mm-hmm. you know, part of the same, you know, economic equation, as if, again, in the case of Canada, RRSPs, which are equivalent of 401ks to an American audience, all have energy stocks in them that profited off of this boom. That doesn't excuse the industry's excesses, but I think it gets to how we can't pretend that this was, you know, parachuted in by a bunch of evil oil giants. We were all part of this, making this happen.
All right, here's my last question, Chris. All right. You've also written a book about the TV show The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. If The Patch were to be a character in The Simpsons TV show, who would it be or what?
The Patch would be a joint venture between Mayor Quimby and Mr. Burns.
I was wondering if Mr. Burns.
Yeah. So Mr. Burns would be the one who would see the profit opportunity in it and would love throwing a bunch of money at making a giant ugly hole in the ground. But you needed Mayor Quimby in there all along, you know, telling people that this is for their own good, that this is going to make things better for in their lives, all that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Man develops his world.
Right. Yeah. And I guess Homer in this case could drive a heavy haul truck.
He could drive with some buggy whips.
Yeah, exactly.
Chris Turner was born in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. Today he lives in Calgary, Alberta, where he's an award-winning journalist and author. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.